This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
As a result of studying this mishkafology, is going to reveal something rather important to us to understand about the world. It's the beginning of chapter 36, for those of you who have Bibles. I'm going to read the verses first because they sound completely innocuous and quite irrelevant, and then we'll get into them a little bit. The Eileh told us Esav who Edom. These are the generations of Esav, that is Edom. Now you're going to ask what that's got to do with the shir about women. Well, you'll see in the next verse. Esav lokach et noshov mibnos Kanaan. Esav married his wives. It's all about wives from the daughters of Kanaan. Et Ada bat Eilon hachiti, Ada bat Eilon v'chitai. It's Ohalivama bat Anna, Ohalivama the daughter of Anna, bat Tzivan Hachivi, the daughter of Tzivan Hachivi. The S, Bosmat bat Yishmael, Achos Nevoyot, and Bosmat the daughter of Yishmael, that's Abraham's son, the sister of Nevoyot. Vateled Adol Esav et Eliphaz, the Bosmat Yoda at Ruel. Adol gave birth for Esav to Eliphaz, Bosmat gave birth to Ruel. Ohalivama Yoda is Yerush ves Yalom ves Korach. Oholivama had three children, Yeush, Yalam, and Korah. Eile b'nei Esav, Ashiyudu lo de'ez Kanaan. These are the children of Esav born to him in the land of Kanaan. Vayikach Esav et Masha v'ezbonav et b'noiz et b'chol nafshus b'esav et b'nev et b'hem to b'skol kinyona asher o'chash. Esav took all of his cattle and his people and his families that he got in Eretz Kanaan. Vayelech el Eretz b'nei Yaakov Ochiv, and he went to another land because of Yaakov, his brother. The property was too much to dwell together. And so Vayeshiv Esav Bahar Seir, and Esav then dwelt in the mountains of Seir. Esav who Edom, again telling us, Esav, that is Edom. Va'eleh told us Esav Avi Edom, and these are the generations of Esav, the father of Edom, founding a nation. Bahar Seir, as he lived in the mountains of Seir. Eleh Shmos B'nei Esav, these are the names of the sons of Esav. Eliphaz ben Ada, Eshet Esav. Eliphaz the son of Ada, the daughter of his wife Esav. Reuel bat Bosmat, Eshet Esav. Reuel the son of Bosmat, the wife of Esav. All of this we've heard already. Vayu b'nei Eliphaz, and the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omer, Tzfoi, Gath, and Knaz. But Timnah, Hoysofi Legesh, le Eliphaz ben Esav. And Timnah was a concubine for Eliphaz, Esav's son. Okay, let's stop there. What's all that? Why is it relevant? Why so much detail? What are all these relations about? Now, when you delve into the midrashic material, and Rashi brings that of it which is relevant to us, you begin to realize a very, very sordid and complex set of family relationships which we're going to analyze. Let's have a look at them if we look at the Rashi. The first Rashi on Bez. Before we even do a Rashi, I want to do a Sipurna with you on this emphasis of Esav is Edom. What is the relationship between Esav and Edom? The Sipurna says on Aleph Lamed Vav Aleph. Is that the Sipurna? That is the second Sipurna on Aleph. Esav hu Edom. Le'olam nivhal lehoim ta'avotov hanifsodos. He is permanently overwhelmed by the enormity of his degenerate passions. Kemosha also beyom shenikra Odom, as he did on the day he was given that name of Edom. Now, to understand the Sikuna, of course, we've got to link it into the Monday night, to last Monday night shiur, of the fact that the passion can be elevated to the highest spiritual level and can drop to the lowest instinctive level. And what the Torah criticizes people for is allowing something as spiritual as passion to serve something as simple as instinct. So to be passionate about our instincts is the distraction of the human element. To be passionate about our higher things in life. And higher does not just mean God and all that. Higher means our relationships, but the spiritual in our relationship, the emotional in our relationship, the human, as well as the physical. As long as it all has its place as part of a spiritual package, then our passions are positioned correctly, and we're using them correctly, and we've got to be using them. When passion serves instinct, that's when the Torah gets angry. And that's what the Sifuna means when he says that he was completely overwhelmed by his powerful and degenerate passions. He was using his passion for degeneracy. As he did on the day he was called Edom. So the Sifuna is linking the character of Esav in to his name Edom, which was given to him when? When was he called Edom?
Red?
No, that wasn't the reason he was red, but that wasn't the reason he was given the name Edom. Because then it would have been a nickname, and we would have been calling him. That would have been like our hate crime. That would have been, we would have been being derogatory because he's got red hair. And he can do about that. He's born with red hair. Torah doesn't get derogatory about people who can do nothing about the way they are. Not that Torah gets derogatory about his people who can do something about the way they are. And he was called Edom, Shibihi Yosor Ayyub, because when he was tired one day, the Iskav Haroyim, after being involved in bad business, degenerate, evil business, Lo Hikir Ha'adoshim Lahat Kiran Bishman. And he came into the kitchen and Yaakov was cooking. He didn't have the ability to notice that it was lentil soup and ask for lentil soup. He asked for some of that red stuff. I said, yeah, what the Sifuna is saying. The Sifuna is using that moment that seems completely benign of Esav referring to a bowl of soup as that red stuff, as indicative of the essence of his degeneracy, that he isn't able to identify something, that he isn't able to take notice of what it is. I mean, I'm talking about big spiritual things, not a piece of Gemara he didn't understand. He was in the kitchen and he asked for soup, and he called it by its most superficial name. He referred to it by its color rather than by its essence. And that was an indication of how completely out of tune he was with what was happening immediately around him, because his mind was completely absorbed in his other, in his business, and his business was distracted, his business was dishonest, his business was negative. So that word Edom, the red nature of it, is given to him not because there's anything about the redness, but about the fact that he referred to food by its color and just referred to it by its real name. That's Esav, and we need to understand that as quite inherent to Esav. Let's go to Rashi. So Rashi says in going through the wives, Ado Bas Eilon. Says Rashi, he Bosmas Bas Eilon. We've had reference to Bosmas Bas Eilon in chapter 26, verse 34. He married somebody called Bosmas Bas Eilon. So now Rashi's dealing with, did he marry two sisters? Or is this the same person with two different names? So Rashi says, and all this is based on Medrash. This is Bosmas. Her real name was Ado. She was known as Bosmas. That was her common name. Why? Benikres Bosmas al shem shoytom mekateris besomim. Bosmas is from besomim. Besomim is incense. And she was a priestess of incense, l'avodah zorah, in idol worship. So that is one wife. She is a real meyuchasik, a girl from the houses of idolatry. Oholi Vama, says Rashi, the next one. He Yehudi. Again, we were told in chapter 26 that he married a woman called Yehudis. Says Rashi, Yehudis is Oholi Vama. Her real name was Oholi Vama. Why is she called Yehudis? Nice name, Yehudis. So why was she called Yehudis? Behukina Shmo Yehudis. He gave her the nickname of Yehudis. Lamashi Koferis Bavay Dezora. Her nickname was that she, as if she had denied idolatry. So it's obvious that his father would come to the wedding. Who are you marrying? I'm marrying Yehudis. Marrying Yehudis, then the father doesn't have to say she's Jewish. If you're marrying Yehudis, of course she's Jewish. What a nice girl. So he gave her the name, he changed her name to Yehudis, so that Yitzchak would think, that Esav was making a change and that he was now marrying a fine Jewish girl who had Jewish in value system, Jewish in the sense that she had rejected idolatry, but it wasn't true. That was just a fake. Bas Ano Bas Tzivos. The third one that is mentioned is Ado. No, sorry. Orli Vama, that's the same one that we're on. Bas Ano Bas Tzivos. She's the daughter of Ano, she's the daughter of Tzivos. Says Rashi, Im Bas Ano Loi Bas Tzivos. She's the daughter of Ano, she's not the daughter of Tzivos. And Ano is Benoishel Tzivos. Tzivos was Ano's father. So how can it say she is the daughter of Ano and she is the daughter of Tzivos, and Tzivos is Ano's father? She's the granddaughter of Tzivos, not the daughter of Tzivos. Shneimar, as it says, Va'ele b'nei Tzivos v'aya v'ano. And further on, we're told that the daughters of the sons of Tzivos include Ano. So there's Tzivos, Ano, Ado. No, sorry, Aholivama. So there's Tzivos, Ano, Aholivama. Esav marries Aholivama, who's referred to as the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Tzivos. Kalamei, that teaches us, Shebot Tzivos al kalosoi eshes Anna, that Tzivos, the father, had relations with his daughter-in-law. He also told Olivama the ben shnehem, and Olivama was born, nobody knows who her real father was, whether it was her father or her grandfather. It was a mishmash of a family, and a totally incestuous family, and that's the girl that Esav marries. So far he's got an idolatrous girl, he's got a girl who poses as Jewish but is idolatrous, and he's got a girl who doesn't know who her father is, whether her father is her father or her grandfather. The Torah is making it very clear that all his wives were from incestuous, they were manzerim, all of them. Then, as a nice little aside, as we go through, that we learn something rather important from this. In verse 3, Bosmas, Bas Yishmael, at least this is from a good family, Bosmas, the daughter of Yishmael. So Yishmael is not the greatest of individuals, but at least Bosmas is from Yishmael's daughter, from Yishmael's family. There's some kind of Yichud. That says Rashi in verse Gimel, for those of you who've got it in verse 3, Ulahalan Koyre Lo Machlo. But we've been told already about this marriage, and there her name is Machlo. So in all these cases, the girls are given different names here from the names they're given elsewhere. And these, the way Rashi's learning through, these names are their actual names, the names they were born with. The names referred to in chapter 26 and 28 are the names that were given to them that they took on during their lifetime at various points. Matzino ba'agorot medrash Sefer Shmuel, we've learned in the medrash of Sefer Shmuel, Gimel mochalin lohem avonaseim. There are three people, three stages in life, that God forgives all your sins in one go. If one needs to add though, it doesn't work if you do the sin knowing that he's going to forgive them. It's like Yom Kippur. You can't say, well, I'll just sin now today before Yom Kippur. Tomorrow is Yom Kippur, and as long as it survives to tomorrow, it's gone, it's finished. Yom Kippur doesn't work for that. It only works for things that one wasn't conscious of when one did. Or it certainly didn't do with the intention of getting it wiped out by this moratorium on sin. The three things are Geshen Iskayer, a person converts. A person converts, a new life, a new being, and God holds none of the old sins on that person's head, starts with a clean slate. V'ha'ile ligdulo, a person is promoted to a position of high responsibility. God forgives everything that came before. V'ha'nose ishon, one gets married. Those are the three cases as well. And that's why we fast on the day before the wedding. So one should say that one should fast on the day before conversion, and one should fast on the day before one is promoted to a position of high responsibility. And one should. But certainly the practice, the minhag that is taken on, because everybody does it, this guy is a rare thing. Being promoted to high office is rare, but the issue of marriage is more frequent, and therefore it's become instituted that the day of marriage one fasts because that is a day of forgiveness, and it's like Yom Kippur, and this is where it comes from. Now how do we know? But I'm at that time, and we learned this mikan from here, the Kachmik read Machlos. That's why her name was Machlos, Shinim Kulu Avonosov, because Esav had a chance when he married Machlos. He married up with the one woman he was marrying that was kosher. She wasn't a mamzer, and she wasn't from a bad family. She was about the best Esav could get, and his sins were forgiven at that moment. What does seem clear is, though his earlier sins still do seem to be held against him, and probably what happens is if one goes through one of these three transformations of life, including marriage, and you don't alter your whole way of being, then God brings all the old stuff back again. It's not that he just wipes them out and they don't exist. He wipes them out on the basis that you're going into a new life, and that you're changing your life. If you're changing your life, you're a new person, and therefore he's not going to hold against you things that you did in your old life. But if you continue after that in your old life, or as if in your old life, then he does hold all everything that was there beforehand. Verse 5, another interesting one. Oholivama. This is the girl who doesn't know whether she's the daughter of Anna or Tzivon. Yalda es Yeush. She gives birth to Yeush, Yalom, and Korach. Not the same Korach we have later on, but his name is Korach. Says Rashi, Korach ze mamzer haya. Don't get anything wrong. Don't think that Korach was a straight mamzer. Mamzer is not a child born out of wedlock. A mamzer is a child born from a forbidden marriage. Well, then Eliphaz haya. He was the son of Eliphaz. Korach. And we have that recorded further on. If you look, we're told quite clearly verse 15, Ele alufei b'nei Esav, these are the lords of the sons of Esav, the children who actually established clans. B'nei Eliphaz, b'chor Esav, the children of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esav. And then we've got Eluf Teman, Eluf Omar, Eluf Tzua, Eluf Knaz, Eluf Korach. The Korach in verse 16 is listed as a son of Eliphaz, grandson of Esav. Here, what do we have? Oholivama, Korach is listed as a son of Esav, son of Oholivama. How can he be a son and a grandson? Explains Rashi. Korach is the mamzer. Uven Eliphaz, he was the son of Eliphaz. Shebo al Eshet Oviv el Elivama. Eliphaz, Esav's son, had relations with Oholivama, Esav's wife. Eshet Esav, Sharehu Manoim alufei Eliphaz b'tuchayinya. So now Eliphaz is the outcome of an incestuous relationship with not his mother, but with Esav's wife. Forbidden relationship. Out of that comes Korach.
I
don't
know.
Yeah, he's part of it. Now Timnah, if we go on to verse 12, Timnah we said was a Pilegesh. She was a concubine of Eliphaz. So this same Eliphaz who had relations with his father's wife and bore Korach takes on a Pilegesh, takes on a concubine. Interesting concubine, so explains Rashi. Why are we told that she was a concubine in Yudbesh? Lohodia gedulosoi shel Avraham, to teach the greatness of Avraham and his family. Kama hayu te'evim lidovek bezaroi. How much the nations of that society wanted to marry into his family, even if it was Esav's part. Timna zu bat ulufim haisa. This Timna was the daughter of princesses. As it says, and he brings proof for that. Omra, she said, Eini zoichi lehinasei lecha, if you won't marry me, halavai ve'yi epilegish. I'm quite happy to be epilegish. I want to be associated with his family. So that's one view of who she was. But here, we've got an interesting thing. Rashi explains that in Divrei Hayomim, in Chronicles, Moine Oiso Bevonov Shel Eliphaz, this Timna, the concubine of Eliphaz, is counted as one of the children of Eliphaz. Melamed teaches, Shebo al Ishto Shel Seir, Eliphaz had relations with the wife of Seir. Seir, the country in which he's living. But Seir, the person, must have been the king. So Eliphaz produces the queen. The Yopso Timna Bibenahem produces Princess Timna. Ukashe Godlo, and when Timna, the princess, grew up, his daughter, the princess, Naseh Pilagsha, she became his concubine. Now look at that relationship. So this is Eliphaz, born into this whole incestuous mess. Seduces the queen, produces a princess, and marries the princess he produces. Not marries, becomes a Pilegish. What does that relationship produce? Vatelet le Eliphaz, and Eliphaz and Timnah had a little baby. And that baby became quite well known. His name was Amalek. That's the family that Amalek came from. The nation that we have to wipe out, the nation that has been the cause of trouble. The nation that we don't know exactly who it is today. There's strong reasons to think that clearly Amalek is spread all over the place. He's not in one place. But there's strong reasons to think, not just because of behavior, but going back into history and into Kabbalah, the Vilna Gaon talk strongly about is that the German nation has a strong dosage of Amalek influence. But clearly he's all over the place. There's been such mixing of nations that there's a bit of Amalek everywhere. Now, we've seen bad family relations creating Amalek. But what does it mean? What's behind all of this bad family relations? What is it about Esau that this is the kind of family that he built? Wow. All these incestuous relationships were that none of them were permanent. They didn't marry incestuously. They had brief encounters incestually, and the offspring from those encounters then had brief encounters, and so it went. But it wasn't the marriages as such that are the main problem. The main problem are these encounters. Now, there was mamzerus, they were marrying mamzerim and so on, but the actual relationships that Rashi recounts are outside of their permanent relationships that yielded offspring. What's important is to go back to Esav's original nature, and one of the problems that Rivka had with Esav and Yitzchak as well. Remember, we were told that Esav was described in the Torah as an Ishur Deya Sayyid, I think was the word. I'm sorry, I'm finished for a moment. Not in my text. And we were introduced to him. The beginning of the verse. By Yigdalu Hanaorim, and the children grew up, in chapter 25, verse 27. Vayihi Esav ish yodea tzayid ish sodeh. And Esav was a man who knew how to hunt. He was a man of the field. The Yaakov ish tom yoshev alim. And Yaakov was a straight person who studied the Torah. And Rashi explained to us, what does yodea tzayid mean? Sud ularamo says, obviously, he knew how to hunt and seduce and cheat his father, and present himself as being far more religious than he was. The explanation, but it's not Rashi who gives this, was that he was Yodolat Sud Noshim, that he knew how to hunt women from under their husbands. Remember that? That was something essential to the way the Torah describes him. And I wanted to discuss that briefly and understand that in relationship to Amalek, that characteristic and what it really means. We discussed on Sukkot the relationship of, I don't remember how we put it in terms of mastery, of almost of ownership of the woman as sodeh, the woman as something acquired, something achieved. And we talked about the challenge of the wife, the need to overcome that challenge, the fact that her husband does not want somebody who is not a challenge, but yet he doesn't want to be challenged. And we differentiated between challenged and competed with. And we said a man wants to be challenged, he wants to overcome the challenge, but he never wants to be competed with. And that when a wife competes with her husband, the relationship is in danger. When a wife doesn't challenge a relationship, the relationship is in danger. He becomes bored if she doesn't challenge, and he becomes threatened if she competes. So her place of operation is the capacity to challenge without competing, which is an incredibly difficult thing. That means, and that's why the love and the caring is so critical. because if you're challenged by somebody who doesn't love you, what do you feel? They're threatening you, they're out to get me, why would they be doing it? And so you can only challenge in as much as he feels secure in your love. If he feels secure in your love, you can challenge. If he does not feel insecure in your love, you have to back off the challenge. If you back off the challenge, he gets bored and disinterested and finds somebody who can challenge you. And so it goes. And if you challenge to the point where it's not a challenge but it's a competing, then he also pulls out of the relationship and feels great. So it's a very, I think that sukkashir really defines the subtlety and complexity of the husband-wife relationship. There is an element to challenge, though, that some men experience, and that's the one that we're going to encounter, and that is the challenge of getting the woman. So in the man-woman relationship, challenge, overcoming challenge, is an important element. And we talked about it in Sukkot as being a daily part of that relationship, that each day that relationship is challenging. And challenging in every sense doesn't mean intellectually challenging. Each relationship finds the area in which it's challenging. But it's certainly a sense of he needs to remarry her every day. He needs to feel each day. And that's what, in the halakhic sense that we have in Gemara Kiddushin, we have this very often, referred to very often, that the marriage process continues daily. But you've almost got to remarry the woman every day. You've got to reconquer her every day with the same things you used to conquer her in the first place. If that element is in the marriage has its vitality. The moment that element is removed from the marriage sets into a taking for granted kind of relationship, which becomes boring. And it becomes secure on the one hand and boring on the other hand. And it just depends whether the man values security or excitement higher. And most men like them both. And that's why they like security at home and excitement somewhere else. But the ideal is to be able to have them both at home, to have security in the love and excitement in the challenge, and no insecurity because there's no competition. If one can get that, then one's got it secure. That's the other element of that challenge, is the challenge of the conquest. So the girl who on the first date is willing to go to bed with whoever takes her out that night is of no interest to any guy unless he's desperate. That's just of no interest. The girl who puts up a little bit of a resistance starts becoming interesting. The more resistance she puts up, the more interesting she becomes. Now comes the interesting issue. What is the challenge? Is the challenge to get her into bed? Is the challenge to get her to the chuppah? Or is the challenge to build an ongoing relationship with her? And that's one of the first things that a girl should be evaluating as she's evaluating a guy. What does he want from me? He certainly needs challenge. What is the challenge? Because once I know what the challenge is, I'll know when the challenge is over. Part of the challenge, and it's the same in business, there is a certain challenge in business to kill the competition. So some people are driven and motivated by destroying the competition. Coca-Cola is not interested in how many bottles of Coca-Cola they sell, they're interested in how much better and bigger they are than Pepsi-Cola, and they would enjoy the demise of Pepsi-Cola. They would rather be, the average Coca-Cola executive would be more adrenaline driven to wake up in the morning and hear that he's closed Pepsi-Cola down than that he sold an extra X million number of cases of Coca-Cola. So there are certain cultures and certain businesses where the drive is destroy the competition, conquer more territory. And then there are other businesses where the drive is to grow the business and to provide a service and to achieve higher standards of excellence and to satisfy customers more. So there's two just completely different drives in business. And so it is in the marriage relationship, in the man-woman relationship. There is a drive, a male drive in the man-woman relationship, which is that of conquest. There is a male drive, which is that of challenge. Conquest is a one-off. Once you have conquered, the game is over. If you're after challenge, then one challenge follows the other, and one challenge follows the other. Ish Tzayid, what is the hunter? Is he after conquest or challenge? When he's conquered, the game is over. He shoots the animal, and that's the end of the relationship, not the beginning of the relationship. And Ish Tzayid, the hunting mentality, whether it's a hunting mentality in business, or it's a hunting mentality in a relationship, or a hunting mentality in a man-woman relationship, in the hunting relationship, the game is over when the conquest is made. And then one person's conquest dies. One man's eyes, the conquest might be, she agreed to come out with me, she agreed to sleep with me, she agreed to marry me. Those would be conquests. The greatest conquest of all is, I took her away from her husband. That's the greatest conquest of all. if one's out for conquest. Because in conquest, what you're out is vanquishing the other party. You're not after the object. You're after the vanquishing. So in war, you've got it. Some wars are fought because two nations want the same territory or the same resource. But sometimes they're fought because one nation wants to destroy the other nation. And the territory is just what they're fighting about, but that's not the essence. The essence is destruction. And in the Ish Tzayid, in the character of Esav, as positioned by the Torah in our introduction to Esav, as is a young man, not when he's born, this is by Yigdalu Hanarim, when they grew up, this characteristic became clear, was one of Tzayid, was one of hunting, that is one of seeking the conquest, not the challenge. And therefore he gets into these relationships. His marriages don't satisfy his desire for conquest. The only thing that satisfies his desire for conquest is the ongoing ability to take attractive women away from their husbands, which he does and becomes a value in that whole family. And it's the value into which Amalek is born. Interestingly, what is Amalek? Amalek fights the war that Amalek fought with us, the first war that caused him to earn his reputation, was a war over what? Was he threatened? No. Was there territory at issue? No. All he wanted was the destruction of the Jewish people. And he used the most deceitful strategies to do that, because there was nothing in it. There was no way the Jewish people could have done anything. They couldn't have surrendered. They couldn't have given him territory. They couldn't have negotiated with him. All he wanted was destruction, because that's his nature. His nature is to conquer. I don't know if there's another nation that has lost as many wars as Germany has. And one wonders why a nation... I don't know if they ever won a war. Somebody knows this, they might know this. I'm not sure if they've ever won a war. But they're always fighting wars. When?
They
thought they did, because that's part of the Amalekite thing. It's constantly fighting, constantly battling, constantly destroying. And even when you know you don't have a chance, that is the nature of these. It's the conquest rather than the challenge. And whether it is that nation or it's not that nation, it doesn't matter. That is essential to the Amalekite being. The Amalekite being is founded on the need for conquest, not the need for challenge. And therefore will always be destructive, just as the Esav type of person in relationships will always be destructive. He will destroy families, he will destroy relationships, he will not build anything of his own of value, he will only take from others. So the Amalekite as the nation is a nation that takes, that destroys, that undermines, doesn't build.
Good question. Reuel was another...
Sure, if it's the same Reuel. I would doubt that it's the same Reuel. It's the son of Esav. If you look at the time differences, it's possible, but unlikely. Yisro's name was Reuel. Moshe's father-in-law Yisro was also known as Reuel. But I don't think it's referred to, he's not connected to Esau over there, so I don't think it's the same Reuel.
The other question is, I remember your brother teaching that one of the only got married the day before he committed suicide.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that comes from. That sounds to me that he's talking there about marriage rather than about sexual encounter. We don't know that.
Well,
Hitler is not
supposed
to be. We don't know that. I don't want to.
Most historians believe that's the case.
Yeah, but I wouldn't bring a proof about Amalek from Hitler. Rather, I would bring a proof from Amalek about Hitler. Because we don't know whether Hitler was. There's a certain amount of speculating. We don't know. That's the only way we can develop an understanding of the characteristics of Amalek is by an analysis of the Tzukim and the Chazal that deal with Amalek. Then one can formulate the principle and one can say who fits into this model and who doesn't. And here this is the foundation of Amalek. This is the sort of hotbed of unbelievable incest. But it's not just incest. Incest is not the issue. The issue is conquest. It's conquest and destruction in relationships. And that's where Amalek comes from. Judy. But a very different one, as we touched on Monday night. If you look at them, it's an interesting comparison. If you look on over there, they were all incestuous relationships driven by the woman rather than the man. The daughters of Lot had to seduce him. He wouldn't do it. He had the conscience not to engage in an incestuous relationship, even if there was nobody else. They had to make him drunk. Tamar had to dress up. There was no way that he was going to have an incestuous relationship that he considered to be incestuous. She had to pretend to be somebody else and fashion a brand new relationship with Yehuda in order to get that. It was driven by Tamar. Ruth and Boaz. Boaz was not interested. Ruth had to dress up and go there in the middle of the night and make him interested. So it's very interesting that in the Messianic house, it is all women-driven attractiveness. The woman attracts the man into a relationship, whereas in the Amalek house, it's the man not even producing, it's almost a raping of the woman. So it's the opposite dynamics, not similar dynamics. But there is a sexual component to both, yes, because the power of sexuality is not just the power of a male-female relationship, it applies to everything. Male and female are two poles of all sorts of energies, and the interaction of those two poles is vital to the understanding of anything. It's in the physical world, it's in the mystical world, it's in the spiritual world, it's in the human world, and every, it's not just human. It is the male-female, male polarity that creates energy. Yes.
But also in all those three cases, the women were driven by a higher principle.
Yes.
So, whereas the men in the Asaph department just wanted to attract their physical needs. So
that was using passion. That was using passion for purpose.
I think that's a really important decision.
Yes, absolutely right.
Yeah. How do we understand, how did he come to be such a renegade?
There's a very important lesson in here, and that is that although we take parenting very, very seriously, and we should, a parent cannot always take absolute responsibility for how their children turn out. There are incredible children who come from nothing, and there are terrible children who come from the greatest families. And while a parent has to do everything they can to guide and to mold and to direct, there's a point at which a parent doesn't have to live with guilt for the rest of their lives. My child married out, or my child did this, or my child did that. The child grew up and made his own choices. And all you can do as a parent is equip the child as best you can with a process to make choices that hopefully will lead to right and good ends. But you cannot dominate the child. And we have this over and over again where good families that have bad children in the Tanakh. Right? Avraham had a Yishmael. Yitzchak had an Esav. Yaakov was one of the few that are quoted as having a complete family with nobody who went off the track. But then you go on. David himself, Avshalom, we've had all sorts of unbelievable families. And the Yisrael Salanta's son married up. What can you... There are just limits to what responsibility a parent can take. Sorry?
Well,
at that time it wasn't the matter. At that time it was very rare and unusual, and it was a difficult and sad circumstance. But it happened. And it does happen. To be strong. I don't know. And one of them was a very talented math professor. And he was given a professorship only on condition he converted, and he did. This is clinging to the children. And the children grew up fantastically. I think we sometimes take our roles as parents too seriously.